Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies and stories of what worked, but also what didn't work, because ultimately I believe teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And we've been talking about what this looks like in a changing world, especially a world of AI. I am working right now, I actually just recently finished the first draft of a book called The AI Roadmap, and it's going to be all about this idea of what it means to do authentic human learning in a world of smart machines, and I'm so excited about it. It'll be out probably late in the spring. But part of it is I've gotten a chance to interview people, and I'm really excited about this particular interview. If you listen to my interview with Alec Koros, we got into deepfakes and some of those ideas. And, you know, what does information literacy look like in a world of AI? And for this particular podcast, I interviewed Jennifer Lagarde. Now, I am a huge fan of her work. She and Darren Hudgens both wrote Fact versus Fiction and Developing Digital Detectives, two of my favorite books on the topic of sort of the future of information literacy. And what I love about their approach is that their particular approach focuses on the human element of information literacy. It treats it as a habit, as a mindset, and it gets into the emotions of information literacy. And I think this sort of view that we're just going to do information literacy purely as a intellectual exercise fails to recognize why people fall for misinformation. Here's a little bit about Jennifer Lagarde, if you have not followed her in the past. Jennifer Lagarde is a lifelong teacher and learner with over 20 years in public education. Her educational passions include leveraging technology to help students develop authentic reading lives, meeting the needs of students living in poverty, and helping learners of all ages discern fact from fiction in the information they consume. Jennifer is the co-author of the books Fact versus Fiction, Teaching Critical Thinking in an Age of Fake News, and that book came out in 2018, and the more recent book, Developing Digital Detectives, with Darren Hudgens. She co-wrote both of those books. You can subscribe to their monthly information literacy newsletter if you go to librarygirl.net. There's a link there. She is a huge fan of YA literature. She lives, works, reads, and drinks lots of coffee in Olympia, Washington. She's a fellow Pacific Northwestern person. I love that. You can follow her again at librarygirl.net or on Twitter at Jennifer Lagarde. And Lagarde is spelled L-A-G-A-R-D-E. What I will say about her is we've met in person. She is one of the sharpest thinkers on this idea of information literacy. She knows the tech inside and out, but she knows the changing media landscape inside and out. And I love that as well. So without further ado, here is Jennifer Lagarde. I hope you enjoy this podcast. All right. We have with us here Jennifer Lagarde. And I'm really excited about talking to you about artificial intelligence and what this means for information literacy and media literacy and just how our students will navigate this landscape.
Yay, thank you for having me, John. This is certainly something I've been thinking a lot about lately, which I think a lot of people have.
You know, one of the things I think about, and we'll get into this in a moment, is you've written two different books that delve into this subject, and they were both at the time so timely, but then they're also so timeless, right? They're so evergreen. And just ahead of time, I know people always plug their books at the end, but I would love for you to just briefly talk about both books because sure. I think folks need to check those out.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That means a lot to me. My friend Darren Hudgens and I started writing a book called Fact Versus Fiction back in 2016. And it was really our response to what we saw happening in the world and how disinformation was being used to manipulate people. And we just sort of got to a point where we thought, well, we can keep complaining about this, or maybe we could do something about it. And Fact Versus Fiction was our attempt to do something about it. And that book is really a call to arms for us. It was a way for us to try to sound an alarm for educators and say, this is the work. Like, this is the work. This is what has to be infused in across curricula, K-12, particularly in a, it's hard for me to say post, but in a post No Child Left Behind world where we have gutted history and social studies and library programs across this country, historically, the professionals who would be charged with teaching news, media, information literacy, those courses don't exist in the same way. Those individuals don't exist in the same way as they did in schools pre-No Child Left Behind. All that being said, we felt a real sense of urgency to sort of sound that alarm. So when that book came out in 2018, that was our way to ring this bell and to try to offer some support to educators. Fast forward a few years later, and having worked in the schools with librarians, with teachers around this work, what we found was that two things. Number one, that most of the existing information literacy protocols and strategies that were out there focused a lot on the tech and the content. And we felt like that was a misdirection, that was part of the reason why a lot of those strategies simply weren't working. And also we found that teachers really wanted us to give them some how to do it. And so our second book, which came out in 2021, the very end of 2021, Developing Digital Detectives, was our way to shift the conversation away from the stuff, the technology and the content itself, because that changes so rapidly, there's no way we can keep up with it, to shift that conversation more to the human behavioral side of information literacy and why we are so easily duped, why smart people fall down conspiracy theory rabbit holes and can't get out, and also give educators some concrete how to do this, start tomorrow kind of resources. So those are our two books, and that's how they're the same, but also different.
Yeah. So one of the things we're going to talk in a moment about sort of the new generation of AI, generative AI, ChatGPT. A lot of folks are talking about that. But one of the things I think is important that people miss is AI is as much an evolution as a revolution, right? It has been evolving for a long time. And the nature of AI is simply it's adaptive, smart algorithms. And for that reason, when we have the AI conversation, I feel like the conversation at some point needs to begin with the AI that already exists, that we're already using on a regular basis. And so, you know, you think about everything from autofill to Google searches to actually spell check, right? I mean,
yes,
everything right. We use. So when teachers say, like, how do I keep AI out of my classroom? The short answer is you don't, you haven't, right? You already have AI in the classroom. And because of that, as I think about it, I think it's really important that we back up before thinking about the new generation of AI. And we do think about how has AI already impacted information literacy? So we think about that question again, everything from searches to filter bubbles to echo chambers. And I'm wondering if you could speak into that before we get into sort of what's up next.
Sure. So AI, as we know it now in our regular life, even though we may not call it AI, we might not realize that the tools that we're using really are AI. To me, they're scaffolds. They're a way for us to make sort of rote tasks easier, from things remembering our passwords to autocorrect on our phones. You know, sometimes they haven't historically been very good at doing those things, which is why, you know, when you think about autocorrect and the frustration sometimes we get with that, right? You know, we can see when they mess up. And so they haven't been quite as scary as something like the new generation stuff, which seems like it's so much smarter than we are, which of course isn't true. But those particular tools have just been used by all humanity to make sort of rote tasks easier so that we can focus our brains on things that are more meaningful. You know, I don't want to have to remember all of my passwords. I rather want to remember what I need to do once I get into that particular site, you know, like that kind of thing. And we come to rely on those. I mean, gosh, John, as two people who give a lot of presentations, you know what it's like to be on someone else's computer and suddenly have to know your passwords. They become really an embedded part of our lives that we rely on and that we just don't think that much about. And I think teachers use them all the time. So much of the instructional programs that we have in our classrooms rely on AI technology to generate data, to, you know, collect information from students, et cetera, et cetera. We don't think about them that much. I think the difference now is that it feels like AI is going from doing these rote tasks to creating things that feels a little bit disruptive to us and feels a little bit scary. But, you know, the AI is already a huge part of our lives, as you said. And I think if teachers understood how it was already in their classroom, it'd feel a little bit less scary.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about is, you know, we have a generation of students who in to a large degree have developed a worldview based on algorithms, based on, like, in terms of what they see on social media, how it's filtered by relevance. And the social studies teacher in me cringes a little bit when I hear adolescents, and I see this with, you know, my kids' friends and things like that, who say, I just want to go on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever. And I don't really care about politics. I don't care about global issues. I just want gamer stuff, video game, this, that, based on relevance. And I'm struck by the fact that those spaces, based on their interests, end up having a lot of information coming at them fast via memes, right? I just think about memes in particular.
Oh, so
The algorithm itself is saying, you're a gamer, you're into this, you're into this, you're going to get this certain type of meme that you're going to find funny. And even if you don't like it, it's going to just flip through. And in that split moment where you're, quote, not paying attention to politics, you end up subconsciously, you know, quickly, without thinking about it, just going, oh, that's true. Oh, that's there. Because you're not even focusing on it, right? And so I feel like already, before we get into this generative AI, which we will, already there's this sense of kids on devices are scrolling quickly and they're internalizing information that's layered with bias, often misinformation, loaded language, and sometimes it's just in the form of memes.
I want to add to absolutely everything you're saying is 100% correct and concerning, and frankly, like a huge part of my work right now with young people is the way that not only is the information internalized, but also the messaging behind that information. And I think in some ways, more or at least as significantly, the emotions that are attached with that information. So what I tell kids all the time is, like, when you are hovering over a meme, or you double tap on it, or you hit the share, you know, icon or whatever to pass it on to a friend, you aren't just telling the algorithm that you want to see more memes like that. What you're telling the algorithm is that you want to feel the same emotions that meme or that piece of information generated in you. So if that particular meme is causing you to laugh, but at another group of human beings, you're going to get more content that causes you to do that. If that meme or that piece of or that video or whatever causes you to be afraid, then you're going to get more content that makes you feel afraid. And so the question for kids I pose to them all the time is, A, do you want to feel that way? Do you really want to feel that way, more of that emotion? But also, do you want others to feel that way? Because when you engage with that content, you aren't just telling the algorithm, hey, I want more of this, but you're also saying, I bet other people in my network would like to see this too. So we're going to pass this on to them. So when you think about how this content makes you feel, whether it's bad about yourself, which we know a lot of the content, particularly on Instagram related to, you know, adolescent girls, for example, doesn't generate positive feelings. In fact, generates things like body dysmorphia and, you know, body image issues and low self-esteem, et cetera. If you don't want to feel like this anymore, I think it's disingenuous to just tell kids to put your phone down and don't engage with it anymore, but we can help them think deeply about whether or not they want to keep feeling that way and whether or not they want others to keep feeling that way. And their engagement is so powerful in either continuing that cycle or disrupting it a little bit. And those, I think, are questions kids can really get behind and sink their teeth into.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you bring up that affective emotional side, right? Because mm-hmm. so much of what we learned, at least what I learned in college, for example, years ago. So internet was pretty new at the time. I'm dating myself. It was an approach to information literacy that was based on authority. It was based on accuracy. Yes. It was, you know, sort of intellectual. It was an intellectual exercise with a checklist, and you go through and you say, is this true? Is this not? And at the time, it might have worked. And given the purpose of what we were doing, which was largely intentional research, it had its place. I'm not saying it was wrong. Mm-hmm. But you talk about, in both of your books, the notion that these older models just don't work for the current media landscape, the devices, the style. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, why those sure. models just don't work anymore.
One of my favorite activities that I do with my own students as Rutgers is I have them select some of those, their favorite tools for information literacy, and do some research about when they were created and who created them. And what they find over and over and over again is A, that the people who created those tools, whether we're talking about the craft test or the, you know, Pacific Northwest tree octopus website or any of those things that are like tried and true that I still see in classrooms and libraries all the time, that the people who created them, they have the same goal in mind as we do. They wanted to help young people be smarter, savvier, and safer online. But they were created these tools at a time when they simply could not have conceived of a world in which we were all carrying around highly powerful computers in our pockets and getting our information from largely crowdsourced resources that are driven by algorithms that tailor the results to us. They just couldn't have imagined that world. You know, that world didn't exist at the time that these tools were created. So, you know, we don't go into the hospital, you know, for an operation hoping that our doctors will use the technology from 20 years ago. We want them to use the technology and their understanding of the world today and of the, you know, whatever is ailing us today, not from 20 years ago. The same has to apply to news and information literacy because the world has changed so much. And part of that has to do with a shift in the way that content creators make money from their content, because we've all sort of agreed that we don't want to pay for information anymore. Content creators now, to some degree or another, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about a trained journalist or we're talking about somebody who plays video games on YouTube for a living or anything in between, all content creators to some degree have to think about whether or not their content is the one that goes viral, because that's how it's monetized. And that influences their choices in terms of how they get us to engage with that content. And that those choices are usually revolve around an emotional response, some kind of emotional connection to the content, whether it's, you know, clickbait that induces outrage, or it's the frame from the video that they choose that's going to make us more intrigued. You know, whatever, those choices are designed to engage us, to trigger an emotion in us that will get us to engage without really thinking. mm-hmm. without really logically considering the implications of that engagement. And I'll say one more thing about, well, really two more things about those older checklist approaches is that they're predicated on two things. Well, they're predicated on the fact that there's a binary right answer to the question of whether or not something can or can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always go back to David Rothkopf's definition of an infodemic, you know, where this idea that a few facts are sprinkled in with things like propaganda and fear and rumor, et cetera, those few facts are used to legitimize the other things. Because if we recognize some factual information sprinkled in with all these others, then we may think the other things that we don't know that much about are factual too, because we recognize the facts in there, right? So the idea that information in 2023 is entirely true or entirely false is just a binary that I don't think is relevant in 2023 anymore. But then the other thing is that those checklists are predicated on the idea that we could find the answer to that just within the content itself, which we know is not true. To really figure out whether or not information can be trusted, we have to look outside the source. And for our kids, let's be real, John, for students in the real world navigating, you know, our information rich landscape, they're not going to go through and try to figure out whether something can or can't be trusted. We have to engage them with more relevant questions that might get them to press pause and think more deeply about that engagement. Without having them to think about, you know, what's the second A in the crap test? You know, they're not going to apply that stuff outside of school. So we have to create pathways, bridges between the skills we're teaching at school and the content that they actually engage with on a daily basis.
So one of the things I'm struck by as, you know, as you describe that is your approach, and I'm thinking about with the digital detectives and that whole mindset is one of the things that I noticed about it is not just a set of skills that you learn, an intellectual exercise. It is a habit. It is a mindset, right? And I'm curious if we're going to get to the lenses. I love the notion of the triggers lens, the access lens, the forensic lens, and is it what motives lens?
Motives. That's it.
There we go. I remember it.
Yay!
Yeah. I share A+ with my pre-service teachers all the time because it's so great. But
thank you.
Know, as I think about, we'll get into the lenses here in a second, but I'm wondering if you could speak to what does it mean for students to take on that role of being the detective.
Sure. So, you know, in school, we teach kids dispositions and habits all the time. There are some things, whether they're actually, you know, written into the curricula or just like on unspoken school mores, we work to help kids develop habits all the time. Mm-hmm. From washing their hands after they go to the bathroom, to lining up in a certain way, to heading their papers in specific ways before they turn them in. Like, we develop these habits with kids because A, they make life easier, but B, because we want them to do them without thinking about it. We don't want to have to constantly remind them to do those things. Darren and I believe that this digital detective work really has to be about that, something that's repeated all the time across curricula. And this is a very lofty goal, but in every class, at every grade level, et cetera, so that they become habits for kids. Mm-hmm. That's why, to some degree, you know, a lot of schools and districts, they don't start this information literacy work until middle school or high school, because the thinking is that we don't want kids engaged with this content online until they're that age. I mean, they're not supposed to have a TikTok account until they're 13. Why would we be teaching them about that when they're 9, right? But Darren and I mean, we're living in a fantasy world if we think kids don't have TikTok before they're 13. But that being said, Darren and I believe that elementary school is really like the most fertile ground for us to be teaching kids these habits and dispositions that can then be applied to the content, whatever that might be, by the time they hit 7th grade or 11th grade or whatever it is. So those habits of thinking about how does media make me feel, the habit of understanding that all media messages are constructed by someone, mm-hmm. and that human being has a blind spot, has biases, has motives. even if those motives aren't nefarious, every person who creates an image on a t-shirt, a tattoo on the arm, the logo on your hat that you're wearing right now, you know, like they, those are all media messages constructed by someone. Mm-hmm. And we have emotional responses to all of them, whether it's a feeling like, John Spencer is wearing a brand that I like too, so now he and I are buddies. Mm-hmm. Or it's John Spencer's wearing a t-shirt that I find really offensive. He isn't, by the way. But
I'm not. I am not.
But we have emotional responses to that, and that those emotional responses influence our judgment and our influence our relationships to other people, particularly in a 2023 where those emotional responses help us, for better or for worse, categorize people. Oh, you must be in this camp because of what you've shared on Facebook or because of what's on your bumper sticker or whatever. We put people into categories as a result of that. So elementary school is just is such fertile ground for helping kids develop the habit of asking those questions. Mm-hmm. So that by the time we are engaging them with content that they might see on their phones or somewhere else, mm-hmm. you know, who knows what those kids will, how those kids will be accessing mm-hmm. content, you know, when they're in middle and high school, mm-hmm. they've already developed the habit of thinking about, how does this make me feel? Who wants me to feel this way? How do those feelings influence my urge to do X, Y, and Z? That kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting as you talk about that. I was struck by, I had a conversation with my high school senior. Okay. And I asked him, you know, how do you determine if something is real or not real? Because we're talking about deep fakes. We're talking about the future.
Sure.
And he said, you know, what we were taught, and it's been a long time since we've had any information literacy, is he's like, we were taught to look at the timeline, pay attention to when it was published. And then you're supposed to, like, he's like, we look at the URL, and if it ends in .org, it's probably legit. And he's like, but there's a lot of really bad .orgs. And he's like, you can go on GoDaddy and buy a .org for anyone, you know? And he's noticing, he's like, this is what we're told. And I said, mm-hmm. so how do you do it, right? And he said, oh, well, I start out by looking at, you know, flipping through it, I'm scrolling. If it catches my attention, the first thing I think of is like, is this too good to be true? Is this wild? Mm, like, I'm just a mm-hmm. skeptic. You know, I'm naturally a skeptic. So I was like, all right, well, what do you do at that point? It's like, I usually click on the profile and I try to see in general, is it like a legit person? Is it an organization? Who is the person? Who's sharing this?
Yeah.
Is it a meme page? You know, really looking at that. And he's like, and then I look at the comments and I look to see if there's anyone who said why they think it's fake, why they think it's real, what's going on. He's like, and then I go usually to Reddit, to Wikipedia. I then go from there into the news and just see if this has actually been reported by any legit news sources. That was not at all in any way similar to what he was taught, right? Like he's hopping back and forth on his phone to different, mm-hmm. to different apps, like the Reddit app, the, you know, and then he's hopping onto Wikipedia that he's got bookmarked on his phone. It's back and forth. It's social. It's looking at the comments to see, did anybody bring up a point of why this isn't true? He's like, I look to see how many bots are commenting. I look to see, you know, do you think this is just a PR company creating, you know, cause there's a bunch of those that are, I mean, there's big ones in education, right? We know certain yeah. quote education sites, like We Are Teachers and whatnot, are just
yeah.
PR companies. And it just was not at all the process that he learned.
That's right. In no world does that look like a checklist. And I'm going to commit information literacy heresy right now and say that in no world does that look like lateral reading either. You know, mm. this idea that we can somehow take this investigative process that your son uses and package it in a way that it works around a mnemonic, or that it, I don't know, like can be labeled in a way that kids are just going to remember and be able to apply. I just don't think if that time ever existed, it does anymore. Mm-hmm. Like those kinds of investigations, they're clue and they're curiosity driven. They are about your son's interest in the content, about his reaction as a skeptic and his desire to know a little bit more, and the clues that he finds in the profile or in whatever then lead him to go digging elsewhere, you know. And that process is messy. It doesn't look linear or lateral. It, especially if he's doing it on a mobile device, you know, there's absolutely nothing lateral about that process. And additionally, it looks different for every person. You and your son could be scrolling TikTok at the exact same time, come across the exact same video, but have different questions about it that would cause your investigation into whether or not it's something you should engage with to go totally different ways. And that's harder work for educators, because there's no worksheet that goes with it. It's hard to develop a rubric that can measure the outcomes in the standardized ways that most education is built on. It's harder work, but it's the work. It's the way that we have to approach this if we have any chance of helping to prepare kids like yours, like Darren's, et cetera, for the actual research they're going to be doing outside of school, which has much higher stakes than the stuff we give them in class.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you brought up lateral reading, because it felt to me, I remember when lateral reading came up as a concept, and I remember enjoying that Caulfield's book on, you know, sort of checkers and lateral reading. And it felt like it was at least getting a step forward.
I think of it as
like
a scaffold.
It was moving from
staying
within the text to moving across.
Agreed.
But and it I felt think like it got formalized into this narrow process, which even, again, doing a formal research project might work in school. But scrolling through social media, I just was struck by, this is still not what people do. It's not what I do. It's not what... You know,
I think of it as a scaffold. I mean, I just don't think it's the last step on our journey. If we're trying to help kids think about the fact that in order to really parse credibility, we have to look outside of the source itself, then lateral reading is the scaffold to help them do that. But the reality is you can really only scaffold on a desktop or laptop, and those are not the tools that our kids use outside of school, particularly, and this I think is really important, if those kids belong to a historically marginalized community, because we know, the data shows us, that number one, kids in those community, if they have a device at home, it tends to be a mobile one. They don't tend to have two devices, and if they only have one, it's a mobile device. And so if we're only teaching them strategies that apply on a desktop or laptop, we're creating an inequitable environment, not preparing it really any of our kids for the world that they really use, but particularly our most vulnerable kids who aren't going to have access to the same kinds of tools that we use at school at home. So I find it problematic in that way, if, only if, we land on it as the last stop in our journey. I think it's a scaffold. I don't think it's where it ends.
So as we think about now, right? So a lot of what we've been talking about is AI, our current landscape of AI, right? Like social media, the meme culture, the echo chambers, the filter bubbles, filtering by relevance, all of these areas of AI. But now we're entering this place where generative AI is so different. The ability to engage in deep fakes, the ability to create an original voice on ChatGPT. I mean, I got the premium and used ChatGPT-4 just to see, and I asked it to mimic my own style from my blog and create something new. And it was shockingly accurate. I'm not accurate. I could tell the difference. I could feel like this isn't me, but I could see where, this is a little bit unnerving, right? And, you know, I've played around with things like, can you do, you know, this famous document in the style of this famous person? You know, the whole like, can you do the Gettysburg Address in the style of Donald Trump, right? Like you, and it does an amazing job of mimicking text. And then you combine that with deep fakes, with generative AI for visuals, for audio, all of these different tools that are out there. Misinformation is just going to
explode, right? I mean, yes. we can't pretend that
on
it's
a scale
not.
We have yet to see. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you were saying.
Okay. I was just going to say, you know, like now there's a certain amount of automation to dis and mal information, certainly in the world. But I mean, because even if you like search a video for, you know, phone farms, and we can see, you know, the thousands of phones set up so that individuals who want to proliferate dis and mal information can do so on mobile devices very quickly. But this, that automation is about to take an exponential leap, because now you won't need the human being to actually write the text. You will, you can have AI generate it for you in seconds, this text or whatever, the video, et cetera, that you want to create to further whatever your agenda is, can be done in an exponential amount of time. Do you remember, John, I don't expect you to have fact versus fiction committed to memory, but I've been thinking a lot about, in fact versus fiction, we highlighted in one of the chapters the story of a quote unquote fake news creator in Macedonia who was profiled by NBC News, right? Mm-hmm. This was a kid who was for a living creating false information to fool Americans and making a lot of money doing it. And the profile on NBC News was all about how this was creating a brand new economy in Macedonia, where at the time, like the average income per year was $40,000 per year. I'm sorry, like $2,500 per year. I'm sorry, really low amount, $2,500 per year. But that in a country where they were experiencing about 40% unemployment. Mm-hmm. And so for someone like this Dimitri, who was making at that time like $500,000 a year creating, quote, fake news, it had also created in Macedonia these other businesses to cater to the Dimitris of the world, because mm-hmm. Dimitri was just one of many, many, many. I've been thinking so much about the Dimitris of the world now and how they are being displaced by AI. Mm-hmm. Like, so these... Weird. Yes, right. So like these micro economies in, say, Eastern European countries that exploded in the early 2000s, 2010s as a result of the desire to produce dis and mal information, now those folks are going to be displaced by this new technology, which of course makes you wonder what the next iteration will be. But all, what I think is interesting to me is that so many of these technologies, John, when these first iterations, one of the things that happens with them so quickly is that they're weaponized, and particularly against marginalized communities, whether we're talking about dis and mal information created by AI, or we're talking about deep fakes, et cetera. These things are weaponized very quickly against vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. And so not only are we going to see a proliferation, I think, of dis and mal information, but we're also going to see a domino effect of harm that I think is kind of hard to conceptualize, at least for me at this point. I wonder what that domino effect is going to look like as the amount of this content grows exponentially.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I had recently on my podcast Alec Koros, and I love the way he thinks about media landscape and AI and digital literacy and media literacy. And, you know, one of the things he brought up with just the proliferation of deepfakes and what that looks like is really he was concerned about what will this mean? What will this look like for, you know, catfishing and extortion, especially among youth, right?
Yes.
And, you know, he brought up, if you have someone who's a marginalized youth, so let's say a student who's transgender and they get AI-induced catfished and they don't have a supportive home and their parents aren't supportive, it becomes so scary how, given the emotions of it, right?
Yes.
How easily they could be catfished. And I really hadn't thought a whole lot about the catfishing side, because for me, my big concern as a former social studies teacher is I'm really scared about what this means for democracy, propaganda, misinformation. So there's so many different layers of what this means, right? And I'm so glad you brought up marginalized communities, because I think you're right. They are going to, it's going to target marginalized people so much more significantly.
Yeah, it already is. When you think about the deepfake industry, and I'm going to, these statistics, just fair warning, I don't have my at my fingertips, so I'm going from memory, okay? So, but something like, you know, 70%, the majority of deepfakes content that exists on the internet now, mm-hmm. still at this point in 2023, can be traced back to pornography sites. That mm-hmm. that particular technology has really been embraced and used by the pornography industry. And by pornography industry, I mean individual creators that are using tube sites to just post their content. So I'm not talking mm-hmm. about like studios that are creating deep fake pornography, right? But so what's happening is, but then about 70% of that content features women and teens of color whose images and AI have been used without their permission. Mm. So you're talking about teens, girls who have content, lots of video content online. It only takes, what, about 12 minutes of video content now in order to create a deep fake of a person, right? Like very little content. Mm. We all have tons of video content online, that content being taken particularly from women and girls of color and then used to create pornographic videos and images without their permission that then, of course, is being, in the same vein as the catfishing. Think about the emotional toll it has on these girls when they, you know, are now videos of them doing things they never did or being posted online and seen by their classmates, their peers, et cetera, getting millions of views. And, you know, what is also troubling is that we don't have mechanisms for removing this content. The giant tube sites where this content is shared are largely still unresponsive to calls to have it taken down. And then even if it is taken down, you know, within seconds, 50 other users have uploaded it, you know, like it becomes like a virus that spreads so quickly. So that's sort of an aside, but it speaks to two things that I think are important. One, what we've already said is that this technology tends to be weaponized against the marginalized first, but then also the reality is that these technologies, and now I'm going to quote the great academic John Oliver, these technologies, you know, are a reflection of us mm-hmm. for good and for bad. They really do reflect human beings. And so now I'll misquote Taylor Swift. In the end, it's us. We're the problem, right? You know what I mean? Like we have to... The technology gets, it's easy to lose control of the technology. We don't understand how it works. Sometimes it seems like the people who create it don't really understand how it works. Mm-hmm. As a classroom teacher or a librarian, we can't expect those folks to understand how that works and keep up with that technology. But what we can, and I think we do in K-12 education at least, have a pretty good handle on is human behavior. I mean, human behavior is part of the K-12 educational prep programs and has been since the beginning for good reason. The folks who are creating the algorithms, John, whether we're talking about ChatGPT or we're talking about Instagram, the people who are creating those algorithms understand human behavior and are making a set of predictions that if they give us A, that given that stimuli, we're going to do B, because they know that that's how humans, you know, predictively respond. And so I strongly believe that our best chance at helping our kids and ourselves and our relatives and our parents navigate all of this is by helping them take control of their responses to things, as opposed to trying to understand and be prepared for every potential iteration of this, because we can't be.
You know, it's interesting as you were describing that, how there's an element of understanding the way media is constructed that you gain when doing some of that yourself. And mm-hmm. and what I mean is, I taught journalism my last 3 years in the classroom, digital journalism and STEM. And I remember people saying, you know, STEM was the class of the future, right? Because we spent 4 weeks of that time coding, and that was going to be the future. Mm-hmm. Now code can be generated like that. Literally yes. every assignment I gave them, ChatGPT can do in 20 seconds mm-hmm. with step-by-step directions on how to code the Raspberry Pi and the Arduino and that whatever. On the other hand, I feel like journalism, taught students how to think about everything from the mental to the emotional reaction that you create in readers, being responsible, being ethical yourself, right? We talked about journalistic ethics as you create content that then I think allowed them to have this lens when they consume that was different because they themselves had experienced creating it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the information literacy conversations I've seen have been really focused solely on what does it mean to consume information wisely? And that's important. But I'm curious, like, where do you think the creative element comes into play?
Oh, I think it's so important. I'm so glad you brought up coding because I feel like the emphasis we've put on coding in K-12 education has had an unintended consequence in that we have a generation of kids who are better prepared than ever to understand how algorithms work, because any kid who's been on code.org or who's created a scratch game understands that it's them who decides how that works. And if they want the users of that game or of their program to receive certain information as a result of playing it, then they have to bake those desires into their code. Mm-hmm. So they understand that coders make choices, that technology is not neutral because they've made those choices as coders themselves. You know, while we tend to think of doing coding in the classroom, in the library, from a purely STEM perspective, I think there's huge information literacy benefits from having kids do coding in school. And I don't think that's been an intended consequence, but I think it's something we can really capitalize on. The same is true for our kids who already are, I mean, want to be or aspire to be or already are content creators who think of themselves as influencers. Mm-hmm. And all the ways that we in school may use tools like Flipgrid or Seesaw or whatever to have kids create content, they create that content making choices. If we focus on the audience and capitalize on the desire to get likes or engagement with your content, then we can help kids think deeply about the choices they make as content creators so that they can then apply that understanding to the content they consume. It circles back to that same idea that all content, all media is constructed by someone who makes choices, and those choices are based on the outcomes that they are hoping for as a result of the content they're creating. We have a generation of kids, many of whom who aspire to be YouTubers, to be influencers. We can capitalize on that. I think that's so important. You talked about like these journalism classes. I taught those as well way back in the day. You know, like I can still remember putting my VHS tape in to have kids analyze a news story from the television. The content itself has changed, but some of those same questions that we might have engaged kids with about the choices we make and what's the ethical choice. And, you know, and then also in 2023, what's the economic choice? Sometimes those things don't have the same answer, but one may supersede the other. I think that's invaluable in terms of information literacy, plus all the other, you know, learning that you can do as part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a final question that I have is, so if we think about students navigating this new, really tricky AI landscape, generative AI, I'm wondering what do you think it looks like for them to be digital detectives using those four different lenses? Yeah. So if you would walk people through kind of what the lenses are and what might that look like, given just how tricky it's going to be?
Sure. So the four lenses, I love to joke that Darren and I were very intentional about making sure our four lenses could not be turned into a mnemonic device. Like we chose those names really, you know, like we didn't want there to be posters with the TAMP method or whatever else.
You could have made it spell lens, right? Like that would have been so much.
I know. We were like railing against it. We did not want a mnemonic. But we created four lenses. And I want to also just preface this as saying that we don't care if kids ever learn these four lenses. Yeah. The lenses are really for the educators to help them sort of classify and sort skills. So we don't care about that. But we created four lenses that we think are sort of critical in terms of how kids view information. And that first lens is the triggers lens, which is all about helping kids practice that skill and develop that habit of thinking about how information makes them feel. Mm-hmm. And understanding that all content to some degree or another is designed to trigger an emotion. And those emotions drive our behavior. And as kids get older, you know, they can think about who might want them to feel that way and what are they hoping they're going to do, you know. But even at the youngest age, kids can think about, how does this make me feel? What does it make me want to do? Is that the best choice? And we, you know, those are just habits that we think are critical to all of this. But then the second lens is access, which is all about considering how the device you access information on and the platform that you access information affects your ability to discern its credibility. And, you know, also affects the content creator's ability to trigger that emotion, because content, of course, delivered on a mobile device is surrounded by all of the features that are designed to get you to engage, you know, whereas on a desktop or a laptop, those things are a little bit more removed, you know. So that access piece is important. Then the forensics lens is about a shift away from finding the right answer to the question whether or not this is real or is it fake, and I'm putting that in quotes as well, to a instructional approach that's more about questions and helping kids ask the right questions or better, deeper questions around content based on the clues that they find and based on how that content makes them feel. Uh-huh. And then the last lens is about helping kids understand the motivations of those that either create or spread mis or malinformation, because the motives aren't always bad. You know, people in 2023, I think we, you know, if the lack of successful information literacy has contributed to an environment where we find it much harder to talk to one another because the information we consume puts us in camps that are, it's very dividing. So we feel like that motives lens is an important piece to helping us to understand the motivations of people so that we can take the best actions, but also so that we can have a little empathy for what people are thinking as they create this stuff. Not everybody who passes on misinformation, you know, is a bad person. Some people really think they're engaged in a righteous fight. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So at any rate, so those are our four lenses: that the triggers, access, forensics, and motives. That being said, as far as those apply to AI, ChatGPT, whatever is next, you know, when we finish recording this podcast, something new will have been invented. I think that what's most important is for us to understand that all of these tools, and for kids to understand, all of these tools are created by human beings who have agendas, who have baked in their goals into the coding that create them. They should pay close attention to the people behind the green curtain, you know, to use a Wizard of Oz analogy, that these technologies are not self-actualized. They do not exist without human beings. And so you have to pay close attention to the humans behind the technology. You don't know exactly who they are. Keeping that in mind, I think, is both important and empowering, because human beings are, you know, have foibles, are flawed, they're just human, whereas this technology can feel superhuman. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is to remember that of all the humans in that equation, as the user, you're really the most powerful, because you have the ability to turn it off. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to analyze it, to press what I think is the most important button in our lives, which is pause. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to put your phone down, but you can stop before you engage. You can think more deeply about what ChatGPT has created for you before you share it. Mm-hmm. John, have you had ChatGPT do a biography of you yet?
Yeah, I did. And it was surprisingly accurate. I was a little bit like,
mine was completely inaccurate. Not only did I write books according to ChatGPT that I never had, but this is the prompt that I gave it, is I had it write a biography of me, including quotes from my critics. And that is a real humbling experience. But I found was that there was a variety of facts that were incorrect about me, but as I had it regenerate, as I would have it do another one, what I found was the same quotes that were from my critics were attributed to different people each time. So not only could I not find these quotes on the internet, which that's a real interesting rabbit hole when you look for people who are critical about yourself, but not only could I not find them, but in different iterations, that quote was attributed to a different person. So I think there's something fun there in terms of having our kids use this tool for doing biographies of people that they know about to be able to not only fact check it, but then also to think deeply about the language that ChatGPT has used in the biography. You know, what descriptors are they using about that person? Those are not factual statements. Like if they're using terms like world renowned or, those are descriptors that are being chosen by what it has found on the internet. And I find that useful for kids to think about and analyze, especially as they find inaccuracies or they find opinion statements that are baked in to the results, because I think that gives them an understanding of how A, the technology is flawed, but also B, about how it's deeply influenced by the media that it's recycling. You know, it's not coming up with these responses out of thin air. It's recycling all of the content that's online. So if they're using adjectives to describe a person or a thing, where did those come from? It's not ChatGPT's opinion. That's coming from the other content that's online. I just think those are fascinating discussions to have with kids that can help them understand the like strengths and weaknesses of it. And from a research perspective, if I'm just like a middle school librarian and I want kids to do a research project on blank, what a great starting point, because then they can research to find out what really was accurate, what wasn't in the results, and do they agree with the descriptors that have been used. So I think that's a fascinating way to do it. But ultimately, to get back to your question, just to circle back, I think the most important thing is for us to recognize that there are human beings behind all of this and in front of all of it.
Yeah, interesting. I love that notion of how students might be able to use that and connecting it to their world like that. That's really, I've never considered that, but that would be a really interesting thing for them to experiment with and to see. Yeah, that's
right. So like, I'm not, certainly not a expert on who the most popular influencers are at this point, but let's just pretend that you've got kids who are interested in like Frankie Grande or PewDiePie or some of these other YouTubers who, having kids ask ChatGPT to do a biography of that person that includes critics, that includes quotes, that includes whatever, that's a great starting point for them to figure out whether or not those things were really accurate. Can they trace that quote back to somebody really? Like, can they really find that thing? And the descriptors that are used to describe that person, do these kids agree with them? Does their own research support those descriptors? Or are there better descriptors that could be used? Like that kind of thing.
That is fascinating. I've been thinking a lot about how to have students use it as honestly, I think it's a great starting place for building the conceptual understanding at the beginning of research. I love the Q&A aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I remember, I know so many people that don't want students to use anything like it at the beginning of research. And it reminds me of the way everyone at the beginning said, don't have your students use Wikipedia. And I told them
start
with Wikipedia.
Right.
But it's been interesting to see how students can use it to build that initial conceptual understanding, or even something like taking the Wikipedia page and say, simplify the language in this, make it a little bit easier to understand. But I love taking it to the next level where they then look at the accuracy of, and the misinformation and the bias within something like ChatGPT, because one of the biggest challenges I see is the number of people that assume that AI is somehow less biased than humans. And that's just not true. Right. And so I love that notion of getting into the bias of the bot itself. I think that's really powerful.
I'll share one other quick story. For the last year or so, I've been doing an activity with educators across the country where I ask them to describe, to pick a word that describes what's currently happening in Ukraine. And what I have found so fascinating is regionally the differences in how that situation is being described. I've seen it be described as everything from a war to a genocide to a conflict to a reclamation. I've seen it described in all sorts of different ways. And I think that's entirely based on the media that's being consumed by the people, the participants in the room, right? So I've been asking ChatGPT to do the same thing, to describe what's happening in Ukraine. And then with a few additional prompts, you know, use quotes from people who support Putin. Use quotes from the language that's used in the response, things like whether or not it's called a genocide versus a war, whether it's called, you know, those are like so fascinating, but also I think really illustrative for kids because it helps them understand that wording is a choice. And the words that we use are designed to trigger a response. And if you give the AI a prompt that causes them to look for responses that maybe fall under a certain umbrella, see how that affects the word choice in the outcome, you know, and the same thing for them, then as they are consuming media, they can think about the word choices that are being used in the video, in the headline, et cetera. Those wording is a choice and those choices are made in the hopes of an outcome. And so I just think it's very, like, it's powerful in that way. That's a tool that, you know, I don't know that we're thinking about it yet really in that regard, but I think there's some powerful applications there.
Absolutely. So for folks who are new to your work, where are some places that they can find you online?
Sure. So I'm still one of the five or six people left on Twitter.
I am too.
I know. We're still there. Like, we're still there holding out. I mean, you know, they're going to have to pry the bird from my cold dead hand. But so you can find me at Jennifer Lagarde there. I'm on Instagram at Jen Lagarde there. My website is librarygirl.net. And you know, I'm still kind of lurking on TikTok, but my primary, you know, I'm mostly on Twitter and Instagram is where you can find me.
Yeah. And you have great short reels. Like I've really enjoyed some of the Instagram videos that you've created. Those have been really awesome. So folks who want to check that out, just, if you're into information literacy, library, we got into a lot of nonfiction stuff, but you do so much, in the realm of fiction. And so if you are an ELA teacher, but also if you're not, go follow her on Instagram. She's got great stuff.
Thank you, my friend. And I appreciate the work that you're doing and for letting me be a part of this conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks for being here.
Librarian expert on information literacy in a changing world. Please go check out her work. Go check out her books. And a quick little favor, if you enjoy this podcast, this deep dive hour-long podcast, would you do me a favor? Would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? I would appreciate that. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.